Welcome back to Current State here from 90.5 WKAR. We're glad you're here. The day after we mentioned that M37 up in the northern lower peninsula is one of America's most scenic lakeshore drives, that's according to USA Today, the Lansing State Journal has on its cover an account of probably Michigan's most renowned state highway. Seems that way to me anyway. I think M22 is the only state highway to earn its own bumper sticker, which pretty much says it all. M22, more than a road, according to the Lansing State Journal. It is Valhalla to a lot of travelers. Really nice piece there today. Coming up on Current State, MSU researchers are trying to learn if young athletes who endure concussions should sit out longer before they return to action. We'll also have a live music from Arlene McDaniel and Ed Fidoa, a couple of performers at this weekend's East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival. That is also coming up. We hope you can stay close. At the top of the show, Michigan-based China expert Tom Watkins argues in a new column that China has stepped up investment noticeably in Michigan. He says Chinese business and governmental leaders see opportunities to grow by linking with Michigan enterprises. The column appears in Dome Magazine, and Tom Watkins joins us to go into more detail on what's happening. Hi, Tom. Welcome back to Current State.
Ni hao, as they say in China.
You say that Chinese companies increasingly are choosing to locate and invest in Michigan. Can you give us a couple of really good examples?
Well, this is a direct outgrowth of Governor Snyder's program through the Michigan Economic Development Program, where they're focusing on exporting our goods and services to China, the fastest growing market in the world, one-fifth of all humanity. So exporting our goods and services overseas, as well as attracting foreign direct investment, whether it's from China or other places in the country. Just a little bit further north on I-75 from Lansing is NextEar Automotive. This is all part of the Delphi and General Motors plan at one time, sitting right off of 75. Today, a vibrant steering columns and other mechanisms that are being produced by good old-fashioned UAW workers, owned by a Chinese auto company. There's many Chinese auto companies that are coming in and working with our supply base here that are creating jobs in pure Michigan.
Is the automobile industry the lion's share of this Chinese activity, or are there other reasons that China's increasing its stake in Michigan?
Well, I think, again, is letting people know that there's something other than New York, Orlando, Chicago, L.A., in Washington State for Chinese investment. We have lots that the Chinese rising middle class, over 500 million people that have risen out of abject poverty into the middle class in China over the last 30 years, want and need. Whether that's Michigan State University, which next year's freshman class will attract 12% of their student body from the People's Republic of China. Hmm. When those families come to Michigan State to visit their sons and daughters, their nieces and nephews, their grandchildren, they see what we have to offer, whether it's our pristine environment from our clean air, 20% of the world's fresh water. And oftentimes where we see adversity and we see problems with shuttered up factories, the Chinese entrepreneurs see opportunity for investment. You know, the Japanese bought a lot of high-name real estate, Rockefeller Stellar Plaza in the 80s, the Chinese are a little bit more practical in their purchasing power, and so they're buying businesses that expand jobs right here in Michigan. And the MEDC has pointed out, I believe it was over $1 billion of investment in the last few years in Michigan. It's getting the fundamentals right and then going after, in a very concerted way, this investment opportunity. Governor Snyder will be leading his third Chinese delegation to China in September of this year. That's in stark contrast to our prior governor that in the 8 years in office never went to China to attract Chinese investment to our shores.
Is the business investment in Michigan you refer to, is that is it essentially all private investment, or does any of this involve the Chinese government?
Well, in China, it's a little bit hard to untangle the noodle. So business and government are tied together in a communist country. But Deng Xiaoping, who followed Mao Zedong, when once asked to explain the difference between communism and socialism and this capitalism that they're moving towards, said that he doesn't care if the cat is a white cat or a black cat, as long as the cat can catch the mice. And so there's a desire to see their economy grow, and they're looking overseas. It's expected that the Chinese are going to invest over $2 trillion around the globe over the next decade. And Michigan needs to make itself an economic magnet for that investment. And you're seeing that not only with Governor Snyder, but Bob Ficano, a Democrat, county executive in Wayne County, L. Brooks Patterson, the county executive in Oakland County, and Mark Hackle in Macomb County, that are all reaching out together with the state chamber, the Detroit chamber, and others to attract this investment to our shores.
We're talking with Tom Watkins, who is a business and education consultant who does a lot of work in China. Do you think Americans are generally aware or unaware of China's interest in the United States, and how important is it that we are aware of this?
Well, it's absolutely essential. Look, the Chinese tide is coming. The wave is coming. We can do nothing and be swamped, or we can learn to surf and ride the wave. And the leaders that I just talked about decided that we're not going to sit back and let China's rise come at our demise. There's ways that we can work together, that it's not about shipping jobs to China. It's about attracting investment to our shores that can grow jobs here in the state of Michigan and across America, and as well to export our goods and services. If it wasn't for the Chinese, Ford Motor Company and General Motors would be in more dire situation than they are today, because the Chinese consumer, when I first went to China in 1989, there was no such thing as private ownership of a car. Today, it's the fastest growing and the largest car market in the world. Ford, Chrysler, General Motors are all doing quite well as the retirees that are benefiting from the stock price of those companies going up here in the state of Michigan. And we can anticipate that the Chinese, like the Koreans, like the Germans, and like the Japanese, are going to be coming here with their car companies, which will also create jobs and wealth in the state of Michigan.
In your column, you refer to over 15,000 Mandarin-speaking engineers just in Michigan, which I found an amazing statistic. Do you think more Michigan citizens should learn the language?
Absolutely. I'm very proud to have worked with L. Brooks Patterson in Oakland County in 2006, encouraged him, which he did, call for the teaching of Mandarin Chinese history, culture, language, in all the schools in Oakland County, and they are doing that. In Lansing Public Schools, they are offering Chinese. Chinese is spoken by more people on the planet than any language. One-fifth of all the people in the world are Chinese. Very few people know, Mark, but of the last 20 centuries, the Chinese economy has been the largest, 18 out of the 20 centuries.
Wow.
And so they are going to continue to grow, prosper, and develop. And it's quite honestly, it's to our advantage to see that growth, because the only thing worse would be their demise and having one-fifth of the population not doing well. That doesn't bode well for anybody.
Does Chinese computer hacking efforts directed at the United States, does Chinese espionage activities, do those threaten these business relationships?
You know, Mark, that's a great question. And what I feel is I get a lot of pushback as I talk about these issues. Our federal government, Congress and the president, ought to deal with the issues of cyber security. They ought to deal with unfair labor practices. They ought to deal with human rights issues and they ought to be vigorous in standing up for American values and American business and America values around the world. At the same time, we need to find ways, whether it's through our universities, our community colleges, our K-12 system, and through business, to develop those people-to-people ties that will bind us together going forward. It is absolutely important that we develop that relationship, because all major issues are going to intersect at the corner of Washington, D.C. and Beijing, the two nations' capitals going forward. And it behooves not only Americans and Chinese, but all of humanity, for our leaders to get that relationship right so that the tide can lift all boats.
Tom Watkins is a business and education consultant based in Southeast Michigan, but he travels to China on a regular basis. Tom, it's always enlightening. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Good day.
That's music coming to you live from Studio S here at WKAR. Arlene McDaniel and Ed Fidowa, a couple of performers at tomorrow night's and Saturday's East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival, sponsored in part by WKAR. And we'll be hearing Arlene and Ed throughout the hour today on Current State. We'll be chatting them up here in a little bit, too. Arlene is a keyboard player and vocalist, and Ed plays the upright acoustic bass. And WKAR broadcasts live from the East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival tomorrow evening. Keep that in mind as well. A study recently published in the journal Pediatrics suggests that children and young adults need more time to recover from a concussion than had been previously thought, especially if they have had a previous blow to the head or repeated hits. In order to avoid a second concussion, there have been calls to hold a young athlete out of competition for a year after suffering a concussion. Current State's Scott Pohl talked about concussions with Dr. Randy Pearson, a professor in the MSU Department of Family Medicine. He's also the team physician for the MSU football team. Dr. Pearson says that it's important to keep a watchful eye on young athletes who have been diagnosed with a concussion.
Actually, concussions have been around for a long time, but our understanding of concussions is improving year by year. What we're finding is that the younger the athlete, the longer time it actually takes for the brain to heal. And so we want to be particularly careful with the younger athletes.
I think we might be smart to define what a concussion is. I think a lot of people hear the word concussion and they think blow to the head, lose consciousness for a while, sometimes a fairly quick recovery, even go back into a game you hear about from time to time. But I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that. Can we get into some more clinical detail of what really a concussion is?
Sure. Right now we go by the standards set forth by the Third International Conference on Concussion in Sport. And their definition was that concussion is a complex pathophysiologic process that involves a blow to the brain that can either be as a result of a hit from one player to another or a hit from a player to another object like the ground. And what actually happens is that you think of the brain as a soft tissue organ within the skull, and it moves back and forth. And the contact between the brain and the skull wall, which actually the skull's there to protect the brain, but what happens is that the brain actually becomes bruised. And that bruising process results in interruptions in the normal electrical function within the brain.
There are lots of sports camps underway all summer long on the MSU campus, including football camps. It gives you a chance, I suppose, to see even younger athletes than the college-age athletes you tend to work with. What's the role of sports camps in all of this discussion about concussions?
One of the really important things that happens at a sports camp is that our coaching staff is involved in teaching younger athletes appropriate technique. And we're finding more and more that it's a lot about technique and as well as the equipment that the athlete wears in order to protect them and in order to keep them safe when they're playing a collision sport like football.
We've heard about progress that's been made in the design of football helmets. Can you address that and whether, in your opinion, it really has helped prevent or lessen the severity of concussions?
Well, certainly the helmet design is improved over what it was, you know, 40 or 50 years ago, with newer materials that they use as well as the appropriate padding and bladders that they put in the helmet to make them fit appropriately. One of the biggest problems we have is that sometimes the athletes don't like the way they fit, and so they want to make the helmet a little bit looser, which actually defeats a lot of the purpose of the padding within the helmet.
Are you supportive of the rules changes that seem to roll out pretty much every season in football that are designed to address this issue?
I think the rules changes are well-intentioned, but unfortunately we see sort of an uneven enforcement of the rules. And so there are many times when I'll talk to an official on the sidelines about what looks to be an illegal hit that doesn't get called. And the only way that we can actually fix the system is to have those hits called. Some people have suggested that, you know, now they take an athlete out for a play when they have their helmet come off. It may very well be that an illegal hit might result in having a player sit out for a period of time. So then that player actually gets the idea that what they did was not a proper hit.
Tell us about the protocol that you go through with an athlete when you think there may have been a concussion during competition. What do you do, and what are the deciding factors in how soon or how not soon, I suppose, an athlete might be allowed to return?
So any athlete that's hurt on the field at Michigan State gets an immediate evaluation by one of our staff athletic trainers. In that initial evaluation, they're basically looking at the ABCs, making sure there's appropriate airway, that the athlete's conscious, that they don't have any pain in their neck, which might indicate a cervical spine injury. Once that's all been established, then we'll have the athlete stand and walk to the sideline, which is when I usually take over. I do an initial evaluation, including a neurologic examination and a mental status examination, where I ask them a number of questions. Once the questioning is over, and I can tell based on my experience and the responses of the athlete whether or not it appears as though there's something going on with that athlete. If I check out the athlete and everything looks totally normal, then we may have them observed on the sideline for a short period of time before we put them back in. If it's abnormal, then we take them out. And nowadays, when we take them out of a game for a head injury, they're out for that game. The next day, actually, in the locker room after the game, we'll reevaluate the athlete. We have some instruction sheets that we send home with them, their parents, or their roommate, so that they can watch for things like prolonged loss of consciousness or worsening headache. And then we'll evaluate them the next day. We use a tool called IMPACT, which is a computerized neurocognitive test. There are a lot of those on the market. It just happens to be the one that we use. And with that test, we actually can do some more sophisticated evaluation of the athlete the next day. We do an initial evaluation with IMPACT before anybody starts their beginning year at Michigan State. So we have a baseline to look back on. We can see if there's any abnormalities, looking at things like memory and reaction time and that sort of thing. Based on our subsequent evaluations and then serial IMPACT testing, which we do every 2 to 3 days, then we can establish whether or not the athlete has recovered to a point where they can go back and start some exercise. And then we always reevaluate them during exercise so that we know that they don't have symptoms that are caused by the exercise.
Dr. Pearson, what's your advice to the youngest football players and their families and their coaches where there isn't a medical team on hand at every practice and every game? I don't quite know, I suppose, what age kids start playing football these days, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, I suppose. What do you say to them?
They actually start quite a little bit younger than that. You know, even first and second graders do some relatively non-contact. Now, fortunately, the body forces that are generated by these younger athletes tend to be not nearly as strong as they are in the older individuals. So in our college age and high school age, they can generate a lot more force than the younger kids can, which is a good opportunity to teach appropriate technique. And usually what that involves is I always tell the younger kids to see what they're tackling. So if they tackle with their face mask forward, then they're not incurring a huge amount of force transmitted into the skull and then down into the spinal cord. So it's always a good idea to do that. The other thing is that if you initiate contact with your body rather than your head, you actually can generate more force with the body. But people think that using the head as a spear tends to make it more forceful, and actually the body tackles not only generate more force, but they're also more effective. So, you know, we see kids all the time that grab and dive at players, and they don't make as many tackles as the one who actually engages the player with their body.
This sort of thing can happen accidentally. I remember one time when I was a kid in school in a gym class running backwards and falling, losing control and falling, and the back of my head hitting the floor. This isn't all related to tackling form in football. These things can happen accidentally. So what should players and parents and coaches look for in terms of thinking there may have been a concussion?
That's correct. And actually, we see concussions outside of sports, too. You know, I'm a family physician, and I see people in my office who've fallen at their house and they hit their head. Hillary Clinton fell and hit her head. She had a concussion. So some of the things you look for are a headache, some visual changes. There can be photophobia, so people are really sensitive to light. They may be excessively fatigued. Emotional lability, where they tend to cry a lot. That's one of the other things that happens. They actually studied signs of concussion, and what they found was the most often reported sign was what they call fogginess. So it's a sense that the person just doesn't feel right, that there's some sort of a fog going on in their mental processes. So that's the kind of thing that I would say you should look for initial presentation of a concussion.
Nausea, too, you hear about that.
People can get sick to their stomach. There's a whole long list of things that people can get. The important thing, though, is to look for symptoms that worsen. Symptoms that worsen may be associated with more severe problems like subdural hematomas or bleeding into the brain. And so those are the things that you should not ignore. And fortunately, most of the time, even though it can be prolonged, most people with a concussion will have stable symptoms that improve over time.
Part of the discussion in recent weeks is a recommendation that if a young athlete is diagnosed with having had a concussion, that they be held out of competition for a full year. Do you support that?
Actually, every concussion is different. And most of the time we know that if an athlete has a concussion and their symptoms are gone with exercise, then they can safely resume participation. But the important thing to remember is that you have to wait until the symptoms are gone. And so using a tool like IMPACT or a tool like the SCAT, which is a sport concussion assessment tool, allows a physician to track symptoms over time and make sure that the individual actually has recovered totally. The big problem with the young athlete is not that it takes a year to recover, but that we don't recognize that they're not recovered.
I envisioned that leading to pressure in some cases to use any word but concussion in deciding what's wrong with an athlete so that they don't have to be held out for a year. Would that be a concern?
Well, again, I think the appropriate thing would be to educate the medical providers as well as the parents into the signs and symptoms of concussion and then treat that appropriately. I don't think there's anything bad about calling it a concussion. It's just that we need to understand that everyone is different, and to have a blanket rule like you can't play for a year, you can't play for a week, really defeats the purpose of watching people over time.
Dr. Randy Pearson works with the MSU football program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Scott. It was my pleasure.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
Live music today on Current State from Arlene McDaniel and Ed Fidoa. They will be performing this weekend at East Lansing's Summer Solstice Jazz Festival in downtown East Lansing. And we'll hear more from Arlene and Ed coming up on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us today. Scientists here at Michigan State University have produced some thought-provoking new research on the effectiveness of groups, specifically environmental action groups. The findings indicate that the size of a group can dramatically influence how successful the group's actions are. Dr. Django Jack Liu holds the Rachel Carson Chair in Sustainability at MSU and is the director of the Center for Systems Integration and Sustainability, and he joins us now to talk about the study and its implications. Welcome to Current State.
My pleasure. Thank you.
As simply as you can, what were you trying to learn in your study?
What we're trying to learn is that to see how effective different group size will affect the environment outcome. In our case, we use the Onan Nature Reserve, which is a nature reserve for pandas. The endangered species were well known in China. Mm-hmm. And to protect the forest, and which is part of the important habitat for the pandas, and the government provides subsidies for the local households to monitor the forest. And so they send the forest parcels to different households to monitor them. If they can be protecting the forest, and then they will get a certain amount of the money from the government. If they don't, they will get punishment. So those households were assigned different parcels of forest to monitor. So you have households who could be different group size, you know, some household, you have two households as group, three or four or five, up to 16 households as a group. So what we found was when the group size is in the middle, like nine households as a group, then the forest outcome is the most optimal, means the forest is the most protected.
So not too many people at work and not too few people at work, basically.
Right.
And is there implications from your study for other organizations? Is there a formula, for example, that you may have come up with for determining the optimal size of a workforce?
Yeah, we think this research has broad implications for other types of groups, other types of organizations. Even in the classroom, like at Michigan State University, for example, if you have student research project, if you send too many students in the project, then some students may take advantage of other people. Say they are free riders. They don't do much work, but they still get credit.
Right.
If you have too few people in the project, then they don't have enough manpower to get the project done effectively.
It's interesting you embarked on this study when the jobless rate in the United States and Michigan remains stubbornly high. Arguably, a lot of companies and organizations have been short-staffed for a number of years. Would you advise them to look into your findings?
The research could have some implication for their organizations as well. If you have too many people, some people may not work as hard as they should be, and so they are free riders. If you have too few people, then the companies may not be able to accomplish the jobs they want to accomplish.
Tell us a little bit more about the setting here, though. This was in China at a nature preserve where pandas are monitored very closely. What part of the country? And tell us a little bit more about the families involved.
Yes. Our study site is in the southern west part of China, Sichuan Province.
Sichuan.
Yes, mm-hmm. Sichuan Province. It's in a rural setting, and the households require local resources like a forest to support their families, and they are farmers mostly, but they also rely on the forest as a fuel wood, and which is a major energy source to cook food and to heat up the houses in the wintertime.
Okay. And is this the location where all of the panda population is centered? Is all of the world's population of pandas in Sichuan?
Sichuan is the major home to pandas in the wild. And there are two other provinces in China also have some pandas, but Sichuan has the highest number of wild pandas. And also, this is the location that provides pandas to many zoos around the world. Like the pandas in Washington Zoo come from this panda reserve. The pandas in San Diego Zoo actually also come from this nature reserve.
Did the participants in the study understand what you were trying to study? Did they understand what they were a part of there?
I think they understand what they need to do, but they actually not in the beginning was not aware of what we're trying to start them, because if they were, they may behave differently.
Okay.
No, that's and they know to protect the forest, they can get some money from the government. And but also they know if they spend too much time on it, it's not worthwhile. So that's how this group behavior is important to study, and then how to make them more effective in the meantime, save money.
But the study was not about, it was, you were using a setting where there are panda populations, but you were really studying human beings, not the pandas.
Right, yes, but it has implication for the pandas, because if the forest is well protected, then the panda habitat will be protected, because pandas depend on the forest as a habitat.
Just to clarify a word that we hear so much of mm-hmm. these days that mm-hmm. some people may not fully understand, what exactly, how do you define sustainability?
Sustainability is the ability of the environment or socioeconomic to maintain a good condition for a long time. So I will emphasize the long time, the time frame for a long time. That's the important phrase.
Of all of the settings to study this,
uh-huh.
What made you choose this area in Sichuan?
Yeah. So
seems like you could have studied a lot of different places for this. Why did you choose that one?
Right. So this has a long story. And we have been doing research in this area for 17 years. So in the beginning, what I'm trying to do is to provide solutions to protect the pandas. As you know, many people have studied the biology of the pandas, which is important. So how many baby pandas can a mother panda can have, and how much bamboo a panda can eat. All those kind of things are important. But the critical thing is the human impact. And the panda habitat were distracted by human activities. If we don't understand, we don't have solution to this problem, then pandas cannot be saved. So that's why we chose this reserve, because there are a lot of people inside the reserve. This is different from nature reserves in the U.S. or other developed countries. In China, as in many other developing countries, most of the nature reserves actually have local people in it, because they have been there for generations. And once the government established a nature reserve, sometimes the government is trying to move those people out of the nature reserve, but those people don't want to move out. They have been there for many, many generations. They're used to the local environment.
I'm thinking of wildlife in Africa,
right,
as well. Does your study have implications for managing wildlife and native populations of animals in Africa as well?
Yes. Yes,
yeah.
Because this is
yeah.
I think the main thing is to see how humans interact with the environment. So that's I think important. In Africa, people also need to use local resources. When they use local resources, they will have impact on wildlife habitat. And actually, we applied this research approach to Nepal, the tigers.
Oh, yeah.
And tigers, how tigers interact with people, how people activities affect tiger habitat. And one of my students actually published a very interesting paper last year, and found out that actually sometimes people and tigers can coexist, but the people affect the tigers by force the tigers to be more active during the night when people are not that active during the night.
I see.
So even though they share the same place.
How did you get into this line of work?
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by the nature, but also I was concerned how nature is affected by human activities. So I was hoping to find solutions to address the challenges that the nature is facing, how people can benefit from the nature in the meantime, can protect the nature, and so that we can maintain sustainability, so make the nature to be in good condition for a long time.
How long have you been the Rachel Carson Chair at Michigan State?
For 9 years, since 2004, yes.
And how long do you intend to stay the Rachel Carson Chair?
Forever.
That's quite a sustainable situation.
Yeah, sustainable,
is what
yes.
We call that. Yeah. What is Rachel Carson's heritage? Is there sufficient awareness of what she did?
Yes, Rachel Carson was an environment pioneer. And actually, she really was a major player to push the environment movement in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And actually, in modern environment movement in general around the world. Her famous book, Silent Spring, actually was a landmark publication.
Without a doubt.
Right,
yeah.
Which increased the awareness of people. But also she suffered a lot of resistance and criticism from people who did not understand her work. And also her work will have impact on some industry which may affect their short-term economic return. But in the long run, her work will benefit those people and the environment for a long time.
Very good. Dr. Yeah. Django Jack Liu holds the Rachel Carson Chair in Sustainability here at Michigan State University. We've been talking about his study about the effectiveness of groups related to their sizes. Thank you, Dr. Liu.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Arlene McDaniel and Ed Fidowa performing live here today on Current State. Across Michigan, there's a growing urban livestock movement. Chicken coops are popping up in city dwellers' backyards. WKAR's Peter Worf joined Michigan State Farmers Market Association Director Drew Montry to discuss the growing popularity and benefits of small chicken farming.
We have friends, too, that raise, you know, two hens or four hens, and even Bath, our community, just approved the backyard chicken ordinance.
Right.
And so I think, you know, the benefit is there's, you know, that connection for your family and your children to local foods. Overall, hens definitely, like any animal, any pet that you have, take some responsibility in keeping, it's a good learning opportunity, taking care of another animal. But unlike other pets, hens give you eggs every day. They produce something. And so I think that eggs are probably one of the products that you can really tell farm fresh versus store. And it's not just in the color of the egg. It's in how hard the shell is. Yeah. It's in the taste. It's in the color of the yolk. And
yes.
So it's really it's a kind of a really rewarding local food production because you can see how tremendous that quality is from that hen in your backyard.
I know what you're talking about with the color of the yolk because I saw someone breaking a farm fresh egg recently and it was red.
Yeah, I mean, in the spring too, like early spring, like May and June, when the grass is coming in and it's green and then you're getting dandelions. And if your hens are in your backyard, you know, obviously their diet affects their yolk. And so they can be so bright. And
yeah.
I know we've in the past made cheesecake with eggs. And, you know, people look at it and they're like, why is your cheesecake yellow? Well,
yeah.
You know, sometimes it depends on the yolk you know, the color of the yolk of the egg. And so I think raising hens is, you know, definitely takes time, but it's also something that on a small scale you can do. Feed them once a day. You make sure that their coop is clean. You make sure they're protected from predators. But, you know, after you kind of introduce them to your coop, you can let them out in their yard. They'll go back to roost every night. And it's really, you know, something that's pretty rewarding experience. And
does it take a lot of time to take care of them? Let's say, well, let me ask you, let's say I have sort of just an average size backyard, 50 feet by 100 feet, let's say. Is that enough room for me to get started?
Yeah, I would think that that's enough room. And of course, you'll have to think through if you want a mobile chicken coop, like a chicken tractor, or if you'd want kind of a more permanent fixture. You definitely have space for that. And I'd also add, if you have children, chickens are pretty forgiving and pretty tolerant. And so they can be chased a little bit and they forget, pretty quickly. And they can interact with your children, and your children, you know, would probably enjoy that.
Drew Montry is the director of the Michigan Farmers Market Association and owner of 10 Hens Farm in Bath, Michigan. Drew, thanks again.
Yeah, thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Summer officially arrives at 1:04 a.m. tomorrow as we head into a summer solstice weekend. It's one of the longest days of the year this weekend, which also means locally that it's time for East Lansing's annual Summer Solstice Jazz Festival. We've had the pleasure of listening to festival performers Arlene McDaniel and Ed Fidawa much of the hour, and they join us now at the Current State microphones. Arlene and Ed, welcome.
Good morning.
Hi, Mark.
Arlene, you've been playing and teaching music in the area for a long time. Tell us a little bit about your career. How did you first get into music, and how did you get into jazz?
Well, I was always a pianist. As I was a youngster, took traditional piano lessons as a child. I think by the time I was in high school, I realized I wanted to make this my life. Originally, I wanted to just be a piano teacher, inspired by my own teacher. So I went to Michigan State as a music student, and I met Ron Newman, and my life changed. I loved jazz. I just fell in love with jazz, and I actually saw Chick Corea perform live, and it sounds kind of hokey, but one of those things that changes your life. When you hear this performance, I said, that's what I'm going to do. So I was able to continue to study and get my degree, but emphasize more jazz performance. And with the help of my advisors, I kind of created my own little hybrid program. Although I did get a theory composition degree, my main focus was on writing and performing jazz. So I started playing gigs around East Lansing in about 1981.
Did you see Chick Corea locally or nearby?
No, it was at the Royal Oak Music Theater.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I've seen him many times since, but that was my first time hearing him.
What a career. I mean, yeah. You want a nice long... that guy has cut more records. It's amazing.
I know, it is.
Inspirational player for an awful lot of people.
Exactly.
What do you like most about... What do you remember about that performance?
Well, I got to go backstage because I was there with a teacher. I was in a summer jazz studies program at the time at Henry Ford Community College, and he got us backstage passes, me and the friend I was with. And we met him backstage, and, you know, we're probably, 18, 19 years old, and he said, are you musicians? And we kind of went, yes. So
yeah.
That was the thing that stuck out the most to me.
Who was in the band back then?
It was an acoustic performance.
Oh, okay.
It was just him, and then Gail Moran was singing.
Okay. Oh,
so,
yeah.
His wife. Yeah. So that was really what stuck out to me, is that I got to meet him. And
Ed, tell us about your career. You're a familiar fixture on the stage Greater Lansing Symphony Orchestra, but you play the acoustic as well.
Right. Well, I grew up playing rock and roll, when I was a kid. There were garage bands. I mean, every house had a band in the garage, practically.
Yeah.
And so I was one of those kids.
How did you make the transition to jazz?
Well, I was in a band, a horn band in the early 70s, and I was traveling back and forth to gigs. And these horn players, they were all into jazz. And, the rhythm section, we were all rockers. And it was a band like BS&T.
Oh, sure.
So after about a year of just being pounded with stuff, finally I started kind of getting what was going on. But they were playing some out stuff. They were playing Pharoah Sanders live in Seattle. If you know anything about jazz recordings, that's... as out there as it gets. So then they got into some more accessible music, like Creed Taylor Productions, Red Clay by Freddie Hubbard. Or anyway, it just kind of crept into my soul, more or less.
But so you've played rock, classical, and jazz.
Yeah, pretty much have done it all, you know.
What, Arlene, what's your most memorable venue you've ever played? In mid-Michigan, let's say.
Well, I was able to play at the Montreux Detroit Jazz Festival with the Sisters in Jazz group and back in the 90s.
Ed, what about you?
Oh, gee. Well, I played some of those gigs. We backed up some really fine performers. The Lansing Symphony's backed up a lot of great, you know, soloists. I've done some gigs, with Fathead Newman, just people like that.
Wow.
You know, just a lot of different things like that.
How has your profession changed over the years here? It's been 30-plus years for you, Arlene.
Yes.
How has it changed?
Well, it kind of goes in cycles here, this Lansing area. It kind of ebb and flow kind of thing. There'll be
tied
spurts.
To what?
Well, just the scene, the venue scene, you know, the music scene, the jazz scene here. There's up and down venues. I mean, you just get something started here, and then it's an unfortunate circumstance that it closes down. So we just have to keep pushing on. We can't be discouraged by maybe the lack of venue support in the area. So.
It must rely an awful lot on just inspired people who really care about live performance and how
it
invested
does.
They are mm-hmm. in that process. Yeah. Would you agree, Ed?
I agree. And performers, we want to play. You know, that's what we do. So we're always looking for venues. You know, whenever a new club opens up, the musicians are lined up at the door.
Yeah.
You know, do you need a band?
Right.
You know, this is, and then if the club
we're
doesn't
not in
make
it, for
it
the money.
You know, it's not the band that closes the club. It's just some things just don't work out. You know, a lot of businesses, new businesses, just don't make it. But we're always ready to play, and that's just how it is.
When are you guys on stage this weekend?
I'm the opening act on Friday with a quintet. So.
That means that our listeners will be hearing you again probably on Friday night here, because WKAR is broadcasting Friday night with Peter Wharf from the East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival.
Right.
So if you liked what you've heard today,
4:30.
you'll hear Arlene. Oh, okay, you're a little on the early side.
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
4:30. And Ed, you're with Arlene?
No, I'm not with Arlene,
as
a matter of fact, because she has a regular group, but her bass player's out of town.
Okay.
So I'm just filling in for him.
But we've played
Gene
together
Reback.
For years.
Oh, yeah. I've known Arlene since she was this high.
I've always
can't
been
see
this high.
An inch. Anyway, I'll be with the Lansing Symphony Jazz Band, Big Band, at 10 o'clock that night, directed by Ron Newman. And that's a great band. It's got a lot of stellar players. And
What is it about bassists? They're always the stoic, Buddha-like figures in the band. Would you agree with me on that, Arlene? Is that one
know.
Of those guys?
I don't know.
They're the timekeepers.
Well, I think to be a bass player, you have to have that kind of a personality to a certain extent.
Okay, so it starts with the personality and goes to the bass, you become
bass,
like that if you play the bass.
The bass attracts you. I mean, you're drawn to that instrument because of who you are. Like lead trumpet players, lead guitar players, come on. You know, they're a different breed.
Yeah.
You know? But bass players are more laid back. We just want to get along, you know?
Right.
We just want to, because your role in the band is to get along. You're pulling everyone together, you know?
Yeah.
He's ahead, she's behind. Let's see if we can bring this into where it's at.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be the glue between all of us.
Yeah, I got
That's the idea.
That's the rhythm section.
That's the concept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're going to play us out, Arlene and Ed.
Mm-hmm.
What are we going to hear?
We're going to play a tune that I wrote. It's called Contemplation.
Contemplation from your Michigan State days?
No, it's actually a more recent composition.
Okay, very good. Contemplation, we're going to let Ed Fidoa, our bassist, and Arlene McDaniel, our keyboard player, make their way back to their instruments and remind you that the East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival gets started with Arlene tomorrow afternoon at 4:30. You can hear performances through the evening and then again Saturday afternoon into Saturday night. Always a really good time. Arlene McDaniel and Ed Fidoa here on Current State. Thank you. Contemplation. That's an original composition by keyboardist Arlene McDaniel, who's been one of our special musical guests today. Ed Fidowa accompanies Arlene on bass. They'll be performing at East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival this weekend. WKAR is a sponsor. Coming up Friday on Current State, Michigan lawmakers approved a bill to improve Michigan's indigent defense system. We speak with Chief Judge of the 55th District Court, Thomas Boyd, about what this means for Michigan. Also, we preview Lansing Beer Week. All that and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. This has been Current State on WKAR.